This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 440 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from Shutters Inc. podcast, and joining me via Skype from the other side of the planet, the man who shoots people, it is Mr. Joe Edelman. Welcome back.
Hello, Bruce. How are you? Bruce, I'm a little excited. You said this is episode 440, and I think it's only my third time.
I know. We need to rectify that.
How are you?
I'm really good, and you?
Good. Thank you.
It's funny, actually, because when we were talking last night and we were, you know, teeing up a time to record today, because it's early morning for me and it's late afternoon for you, I got to thinking, when did I last have Joe on the podcast? And I had to go and search for it, and it was as far back as October of last year. I can't believe it's been 8 months already.
Yeah, so indeed. It was right before your partner came to New York for Photo Plus, I believe.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so in between then and now, I finally, after 9 years of shooting with my Sony A850, I got an upgrade.
Did you really? You bought an Olympus?
An intermediate upgrade. So
which one did you go?
I'll tell you the story. I came into a small inheritance after my grandmother passed away last year. And and I thought to myself, you know, I've seen a lot of cameras come and go in the 9 years I've been shooting with my A850, and I've been very restrained in not, you know, jumping on the next great thing that came along. But I really was starting to feel like the 850 was showing its age, particularly when it came to low light work. And I started looking around, and I figured that, you know, in the research that I did, everything said if you go to a Sony E-mount body and you want to use A-mount lenses, which I have a nice collection of, then you need to use, you know, something like a Metabones adapter and or even the Sony adapters. And in doing so, you sacrifice AF speed and you sacrifice, you know, 90% of the autofocus points on the sensor. And so I pretty much, you know, accepted within my mind that I might as well just go whole hog and buy a whole E-mount system and kiss the A-mount thing goodbye, because it's pretty clear that Sony has, you know, let A-mount disappear into the sunset. So I ended up buying the A7 III and got myself a Tamron 28-75-28 and the Sony 70-200 f/4 and a manual focus Lauer 15mm f/2.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I like to do a bit of landscape and astro stuff. So the 15mm comes in handy, and landscape and astro manual focus is fine because you're not having to deal with fast moving subjects. So that was my thinking on that. And then the 28-75 is basically the E-mount version of the very same lens that I had in A-mount. And although I had the 70-200 in a 2.8 A-mount, I looked at the A-mount, the E-mount 2.8 and the E-mount f/4 and realized that the difference was, you know, about a kilogram, which is, you know, 2.5 pounds in your language, of weight, and, you know, something close to $2,000 Australian cheaper. And I thought, you know what, I really don't shoot at 2.8 that often, and I reckon I can survive with the f/4 version, and I have not regretted that decision yet. So I'm 6 months in with the new camera and lenses, and loving it.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, it sounds like a nice kit. I mean, you know, obviously I joke about an Olympus since I'm an Olympus visionary, but you know, the great part about being involved in photography today, and it's exciting, you can't buy a bad camera.
No.
You can see a lot of really bad photographers, but you can't buy a bad camera.
That's right.
It's really a matter of, you know, does the camera obviously have, you know, the features that you want, the capabilities that you need. For me, I think one of the most heavily overlooked features of any camera is the ergonomics. If the camera doesn't sit right in your hand and if it doesn't feel right, that's a problem.
Yeah.
It becomes an obstacle. And then the other big thing is glass. Got to have good glass.
Yeah, totally. It's interesting that you mentioned the ergonomics, because when I sort of came to that realization that I was going to have to let A-mount go and,
right,
you know, start from scratch, I briefly thought about changing to a Fuji system. And I went and had a play with the X-T2, I think it was, and it seemed nice, but I was immediately struck by the fact that, you know, all of the menus were completely different to what I was used to.
Yep.
And the guy in the camera store said to me, you know, because we were obviously discussing where I was at and what I had and what I'd been shooting with, and he said, why aren't you looking at an A7 III? And I said, oh, well, you know, I thought if I was starting from scratch, there was no necessity to stay Sony. And he said, yeah, but you've got all those nice A-mount lenses, yada, yada, yada. And so he pulls out an A7 III and gives it to me, and it just immediately felt like home, you know, because the menus were where I expected them to be. All of the dials and buttons were in the same places. So, yes, there is a lot to be said for ergonomics.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and even, you know, even when you're making changes like that, having the continuity, I mean, my evolution, you know, I had been a Nikon guy for a lot of years, and I made the transition from film to digital in 2000 when Nikon came out with the D1, which, you know, was the first. It was the coolest. It was the greatest at all of 2.7 megapixels. And, you know, for the next 8 years or so after that, Canon pretty much swept the floor with Nikon. That's when every sporting event you would go to, each time you would see more and more and more white lenses, you know, at the sporting event. Nikon just couldn't get their act together. But for me, Canon to this day makes great gear. They're huge and they're ridiculously heavy, and I don't like the ergonomics.
Yeah.
And I went through them all. I mean, I did switch to Sony briefly. I lasted about 8 months, and this was very early on in the process. So they only had 4 lenses, and admittedly, I'm a little bit old school. I'm not a fan of adapters. So I didn't want to have to adapt them, and they didn't at that time. They weren't announcing any immediate plans or time frames for, you know, how soon were there going to be more lenses. And I struggled with the ergonomics because, again, it's, you know, it's like a personal choice thing. There's no right or wrong. So I'm back to the Nikon and, you know, kind of waited. And then it was video that led me into Micro Four Thirds and Panasonic. I didn't really like their ergonomics. And when I picked up the Olympus EM1 Mark II and put a grip on it, it was like an icon in the sense that everything fit, everything was where it belonged. I had read a lot of things that made me worry about Olympus menus. Fortunately, I found out once I got one in my hands that most of what I was reading was early Olympus digital cameras that people were complaining about the menu systems. I actually found the menu system to be 10 times easier than Nikon's or Sony's in terms
right.
of intuitive. The challenge is, you know, from a strictly a pure feature standpoint, the EM1 Mark II and the EM1X, they've got a lot more features than the Nikon and the Sony cameras have built in. So they're deeper menus.
Yeah.
But I found them very easy, you know, to work with in that sense. And that's a key. I mean, if I'm a big believer, I tell this to the photographers every place I go and talk, you know, when they leave my talk, they're going to walk out, they're going to get in their car, and they're either going to turn the key or push the button. But at no point are they going to stop and think, wait, how do I drive to the car?
Yeah.
At least I hope they're not going to think that. Okay. They're going to think about the traffic. They're going to think about their direction, but they don't have to think about driving the car. But yet we go out and we spend insane amounts of money on cameras. We want to get better. We want to take great pictures, but yet we routinely have to stop and try to remind ourselves or refresh our memories. Like, wait, how does the camera do this? Or how do I need to do that? And that's problematic.
Yeah.
And one of the things that stands in the way of making that easier, it's bad ergonomics. If the camera doesn't make sense in your hands, it just makes it that much harder to get there.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of it comes down to just how often you get it out as well. You know, if you're not shooting often enough, then it's
I just make perfect for sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I remember a month or two after I got this new kit, Glenn and I were talking on one of, you know, the previous episodes, and I made the comment that I couldn't remember how to get the shutter speed to go to bulb mode for doing cable release. Yep. And it all came down to the fact that you have to have the motor drive switched off. It's got to be in single shot mode in order to access bulb mode.
And that was
a slight change from my old A850, where it didn't care if you were still in motor drive mode, you could still access bulb mode. And it was something that I had to go back to the book for and go, why can't I access bulb mode? And now that I have had to look it up, I will never forget that.
Well, yeah, you know, making a change like that, it's like switching from, you know, a Windows PC to a Mac, or from a Mac to Windows. We don't really use cameras these days. We use computers to take pictures, which is awesome. I love that.
Yes.
But indeed, I mean, these cameras have an incredible depth of ability and feature sets. And so, yeah, a lot of features are reliant on other features and settings.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's part of learning curve.
As much as I, you know, wanted the upgrade for the better low light performance, or should I say the ability to shoot at higher ISOs without having to accept a ridiculous quantity of noise.
Right.
The other thing that I have grown to love about the A7 III is the eye autofocus.
Mm-hmm.
The way the Sony's, you know, track, you know, people's faces in images just blows my mind. I guess all cameras are probably doing it now, but it just, it's an absolute revelation.
I think most of the newer cameras are doing it. You know, I'll get my plug in for Olympus, and I will point out that eye tracking autofocus, Olympus was the first to bring that to market. And actually,
right?
Olympus doesn't get credit for a lot of the features they bring to market. And that's, you know, even when the new EM1X came out this year,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the Olympus faithful were like, wait, what's this? It's a bigger camera. You know, the internet, oh my God, it's so huge. It's not. It's barely bigger than the EM1 Mark II with the grip. What excites me about the camera more than anything else is the technology, the AI capabilities that are in this camera, and the dual processors, the speeds. It's just amazing. I mean, it's beyond comprehension in terms of where I came from in photography. And to me, so the most exciting part about that camera, because I didn't need that camera, but it's cool.
Mm-hmm.
The most exciting thing about it is that technology is going to trickle down into other Olympus cameras. Some of it simply by firmware. And that technology also continues to push the rest of the market to companies like Sony, Nikon, Canon, where, you know, these features are going to become features that are expected and are norm. You know, even the image stabilization. I mean, Olympus was, you know, the first to have the IBIS. They still have, you know, the industry leading image stabilization that the others are playing catch up. But the fact that everybody is working on that and getting better at it.
Yep.
And right now we could probably argue Sony's autofocus is probably leading the pack, you know, on the eye tracking at the moment. Not by much, but I'll continue. You know, they're probably leading the pack right now, but that's the competition that's being driven, which is awesome. That's part of what's so exciting to be in photography.
Totally.
The technology. I mean, granted, it doesn't make it exciting when it comes time to look at the checkbook or the credit card balance, but
yes.
It's exciting in terms of, like, you know, what we are able to do that, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, you know, we took the same kinds of pictures, but it was a whole lot harder and the results were much more random. Now we're able to with much more consistency and a much greater sense of confidence that, you know, we're going to be able to walk away with the shot that we want. So, it's
now, I sent three photos across to you to have a look at, which I shot on the weekend. And Glyn was going to critique these images.
Oh, I thought these were Glyn's. Gosh, I was looking forward to really ripping these apart. Now I feel like I got to.
Mate, you can rip them apart. You'd be living up to Glyn's normal critique of my work.
Okay.
So the little bit of backstory here is that the guy that there's one image of a guy. That's my mate James, who also rides motorbikes, and twice a year he and I go off on a weekend camping trip on the bikes.
Okay.
And the two shots of the girl are his 20-year-old daughter, Sibylla. And Sibylla is pursuing a career as a professional dancer, and she needed some headshots for her dancing career. And so we'd organized for them to come up to our place, because they live an hour and a half away from us. And so I'd said, come up on a Saturday and we'll do some shots in the studio and we'll have lunch and yada, yada, yada. And so what I want to state right off the bat, particularly given that I was just talking about how great Sony's autofocus is that I kind of screwed up here in that I had set the backdrops up in my garage, and I had the room too dark for the eye autofocus to work. And so there's one of those shots of Sibylla where it's not quite sharp, certainly not as sharp as it should be. I think the camera just missed focus a little bit. And I think in hindsight, I should have, you know, just left a tungsten light on somewhere that, you know, wouldn't have impacted the exposure of the shot, but would have just thrown enough light for the eye autofocus to actually work while I was shooting. So I just wanted to put that caveat in there first.
No, that's all right. And in defense of Sony, and as a reminder to photographers everywhere, the word photography has its Latin origin in the word light. So we do need light for these cameras to work, not only to record an image, but yeah, I mean, the autofocus and that, again, depending on camera model, depending on features, if I'm not mistaken, so I'll probably get some hate mail if I get this wrong, because Sony users, they are a determined bunch, but I think Sony only uses either phase or contrast detection in their autofocus. I don't think they use both in that camera. So folks, let me say right now, if I got it wrong, please don't hate me. I'm not trying to slam Sony. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, when you have a situation like that, there are several different, you know, ways that the camera can be fooled. And this applies to like every brand.
Yeah.
You know, I will say that the two high-end Olympus cameras, they use both contrast and phase, which is a dramatic improvement because it's a lot harder for the camera to find itself in a situation where it's going to struggle. But I've managed to find situations where, you know, yeah, it's really dim, it's really dark, and, you know, every so often it's going to hunt. The camera needs light to be able to see and do its thing. So yeah, I mean, that happened. So Bruce, let me give you a little backstory about critiques.
Sure.
And I have a YouTube video that's probably a little over a year old now, and I'll gladly share a link with you so that you can post it with the podcast. But
yeah,
it talks about people asking for feedback and asking for critiques. And essentially my stance is that most critiques that we see and we hear are completely worthless. In fact, that they're actually harmful to the development of a new photographer. And the reason being that they are routinely done without context.
Yeah.
And as a result, they are just a bunch of opinions. And opinions are really pretty much worthless.
Yeah.
Because in these photos that you have sent to me, as an example, in the photo of your friend, there are really only two opinions that matter. That of you who took the picture because you had an idea, and your friend, since he's the guy that's in it.
Yeah.
In the photographs of his daughter, since you mentioned that she is a dancer and she's hoping to use these potentially for auditioning purposes, there are three opinions that matter. And we could even argue there's a fourth or a fifth. So the first ones are just like with your friend, you and then her.
Yep.
Going down the pecking order, then the next one that's going to come along is her agent, who is going to say yes or no, I'm not going to be able to get you work with this. Then there is going to be the casting agency, who is going to look at that picture when the agency passes along and says, you know, we don't like her look, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then there's potentially also the client that is going to say, well, yeah, you know, she's got a nice resume, but not the look we were after.
Yeah.
So those are the only opinions that actually matter. And so for me, I have a couple questions that I always ask people. And I do this in my Facebook group. When somebody posts an image, they're not allowed to just put an image up there and say CC welcome.
Correct.
For those of you that don't know what CC welcome is, that is the famous Facebook photography group phrase for constructive critique, welcome. But really what it means, it's code, folks. So if you ever see that, please understand you are not supposed to give a critique. That would be the worst thing that you could possibly do. CC welcome is code for please hit like, or better yet, heart, and tell me how wonderful I am.
Yeah.
God forbid somebody gives, you know, constructive criticism on that picture and all hell breaks loose. The testosterone levels go through the roof and it's a big mess. So when I have people post pictures in my group, they've got to tell me, why did they take the shot? Which you've already given me most of that information. They have to, of course, give, you know, share the settings, because I do agree with the camp where my settings don't help you a whole lot, but oftentimes from a mentoring standpoint, it helps me to see the settings to see if somebody's potentially misunderstanding something or developing a bad habit where they're maybe not paying attention to something that they should be. So in that context, I like to know the settings. I like to know where they're placing their lights just in case there's something that I'm missing in the picture when I kind of deconstruct it. In addition to the why and the settings, I want to know if they're happy with the outcome, if their subject is happy with the outcome. And the last question, the big one for me, and I will not allow a picture to be posted, and I will not give it a review because I refuse to use the word critique. I will not give it a review if they do not answer the final question. And that is, if you could do it again, what would you do differently?
Fair enough.
In all my years of photography, I have not created one image yet that is perfect. You know, and part of it is, I will admit by my own admission, I get bored easily. So I will shoot something and it's very exciting and I will do the post processing and it's even more exciting. And maybe it winds up on a billboard, even more exciting.
Yeah.
But then it's like, okay, cool. Next. Now what?
Yep.
Right.
So what's my next challenge?
Exactly. And I have always had the philosophy that there's room for improvement. There's something that could have been different. There's something that could have been better. There's something. And you know, maybe if it was really amazing and I actually did something that was almost that good, then there was still something that might have been equally as good in a very different way if I had changed something. So I want people to do that self-evaluation. Because, you know, I think number one, it kind of keeps us honest with ourselves that, you know, we haven't achieved perfection. And plus, you know, if we're all being honest, God forbid you ever actually do achieve perfection. What are you going to do for an encore?
Yeah, exactly. So
I like to be a perfectionist in my mentality, but I'm also practical in the sense that, you know, I'm not going to get there. So let's start with the photograph of your friend.
Yep.
Because you didn't tell me. You told me that the pictures of the daughter were for, you know, audition headshots and that. So what was the purpose behind this photo of your friend?
Okay, so James had said to me that he's just changed job after 12 years at his last company, and he felt like it was time for him to have a new headshot for his LinkedIn profile. And this particular image that I've sent to you was one that we shot on the black backdrop, which is probably not the image that James will end up using for his LinkedIn profile because we later shot some stuff on the white backdrop, as you can see from the shots of Sibylla. The thing was, I had decided to do the black backdrop first simply because I had set my... Okay, sorry. I need to wind back the clock about 4 years. I got a really good deal on a couple of studio... lights, right? A couple of Hensel 400 watt second lights. So they're not super powerful, not super fast, but they're good studio lights. And it was such a stupidly cheap deal, I couldn't pass it up, even though I don't have a massive amount of need for studio lights. And to be honest, they have sat in my studio for, you know, these 4 years, and they've been used about four times in that time. What I'd been thinking of when I was sort of mentally running through the process of how the day was going to pan out, I thought to myself, if I'm going to shoot a black backdrop, I really need to be able to flag the lights so that light is not falling on the black backdrop. And so I did this absolutely ugly as setup where I taped some pieces of wood to the top of the studio lights that sort of extended out like an arm, and then I hung these vinyl car blankets off the piece of wood so they acted as flags to prevent light from the studio heads hitting the backdrop.
What was the distance from between your subject and the background, approximately?
2 meters, so 6 feet.
About 60. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. So,
how far would you say your key light, your main light, how far would you say that was from your subject?
3 feet, 3 to 4 feet.
Okay. Any kind of a modifier? Softbox or?
I think from memory, let me just have a look at that shot of James. I think, no, I think. I think both of these were naked light and almost at, you know, 90 degrees firing in from the sides. They were just a little bit forward of being square on. And as you can see, the one on camera right, I've had it, you know, sort of probably double the power of the one that was on camera left, just to create a little bit of a contrast between the two sides, because I hate it when the light is even from both sides. It just looks boring.
Right.
So, yeah, so they were, as best as I recall, these were shot naked. Later on, I was using softbox and or a 22-inch beauty dish. But but the shot of James, I'm pretty sure, was naked.
Did you try any shots with this setup without the flags in place?
No, I didn't. Not with the black backdrop, no.
Right.
Do you think that the absence of flags would have still left the backdrop black?
Well, so probably, yes. In this scenario, so the reason why I asked you about the distances.
Yep.
So if we're talking, you know, 2 meters from your subject to the black background, and we're talking a meter from a bare flash head, a bare 400 watt second flash head, there's this thing. It's those three words. So I will apologize, because it's kind of like cursing in the photography world. It scares the crap out of photographers like big time, because it's a physics thing. But there's this thing called the inverse square law.
Yep.
Right. So for those of you that are panicking right now, relax. You don't have to know the math, but you do have to understand how it works. So the really short kind of dumbed down version, and trust me, it doesn't mean that you know what the inverse square law is because you heard Joe Edelman say this. You have to go out and actually practice and play with light to see it work. But light falls off more rapidly the closer it is to the light source.
Yeah.
So having your key light or your main light that close to your subject, especially without a modifier, means that the light's not spreading nearly as much as it would if you had a bigger modifier, because the bigger modifier creates a, you know, basically a bigger light source in that regard. So it's going to spread more faster, and it's going to fall off much, much more rapidly. And if these are 400 watt second strobes and you're at about 3 feet with a modifier, I have a feeling you were shooting at a fairly small aperture. Do you remember what aperture you were looking at?
Yeah, I think this was f9.5.
Yeah. You probably would have still been able to maintain a black background. So it's not wrong that you flagged it.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, like, if you were doing a situation where you were bringing a client in, better safe than sorry. Flag it when you do your setup. And then that way, when the person sits down, you don't have to act like a bumbling idiot, because all of a sudden you realize, oh my gosh, I'm lighting up the background. Right. So, yeah. So it's not a problem that you flagged it, but, given the details you're giving me, you probably would have actually been completely fine without the flags.
Right.
So, I mean, I will tell you, like, I'll give you a lot of credit for doing this with direct flashes, you know, two basically direct flash heads. You actually did a very impressive job of getting the light to balance.
Oh, thank you. Oh, sorry. I do need to. I'm just looking at the image, and I realized what I haven't mentioned is I had a speed light. Yes, which I had on a gorilla pod hanging off a hook on the ceiling. Yes, sorry, I forgot to mention that.
Right. Yeah, no, that's cool. Yeah, I could tell you had a hair light in there, so that's fine.
Yep.
So, I mean, yeah, you did a very good job of, you know, creating balance. Mm-hmm. Now, if we're going to be like super super picky, okay,
so go for it.
Sounds like Glenn is always really picky. So if the idea is to point out things to you that are going to kind of help you really improve and finesse.
Yep.
Let's start and talk about catch lights.
Sure.
I have images in my portfolio where there are vertical catch lights, where there are triangle catch lights, there are circle catch lights. The only people that ever talk to me about catch lights, they are people that own cameras and they look like photographers.
Yeah.
Kind of weird that way. Yeah. You know, I've never had a subject say, ooh, what's up with that catch light? So there's a couple schools of thought with catch lights, right? The diehards, the hardcore, there has to be a right or wrong way kind of people.
Right.
They will. Lights should be round and they should always be in the upper half of the eye. And there's actually science behind that makes sense. The science is, it's cognitive psychology. By the time we are toddlers, like early toddlers, like 2 years old, our brains are hardwired to expect that light comes from above.
Yep.
That's where the sun is. That's why when we walk into a room, the lights are not in the floor. That's why when you watch a horror movie and there's zombies, they put the lights under their face because it creates shadows on the tops of their cheeks, tops of their nose, and it's startling, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm being really, really, really picky, and this is one of those things, so I will apologize not only to you, but to all the other people that have been looking at this picture. Once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. The two catch lights being at about the same height, but both on the outside portion of the eye.
Yep.
Actually make him look a little cross-eyed.
Right.
Catch lights are opposite each other. It's almost like his eyes are pointed in.
Oh, interesting.
So until you know it, it's absolutely fine. But once you see it, you can't unsee it. It's there.
Right.
And so now, if this were me, so let you know, all good photography is problem solved, right? Let's be really clear.
Sure.
So again, I want to go back to my first statement, not to be nice, but to be really sincere. You, for two bare flash heads, you did a really good job of balancing this light. Oh. So literally all I would do is a simple post-production fix. I would go ahead and either get rid of one of the catch lights or move it, which is very ridiculous. But I would also take out the two little hot spots on the tip of his nose.
Right.
Unnatural, but you know, they're also clues. A lot of times if you remove a clue, things make more sense. And you will see it just for your own sake now that I've made him look cross-eyed in your mind, because I planted that in mind. If you go into Photoshop and simply just erase one of the catch lights, you don't even have to move it, just erase one, suddenly he will no longer be cross-eyed.
Interesting.
Right? It will fit that fast in the way your brain perceives his eyes.
Right.
So super tricky thing there. If I'm going to continue to be super, super nitpicky. So again, this is like really, really nitpicky. I would argue that your hair light could be dialed down maybe a half a stop.
Yeah.
But let me explain why. Because again, none of these things that I'm pointing out are like a right or wrong kind of thing.
No, they're subjective.
The reason why I would like to get dialed down about a half a stop is that number one, I hate hair light. So it's important to give full disclosure there.
Fair enough.
You know, I learned photography back in the, you know, 70s, 80s. And when it came to portraiture, you had a hair light. Like, it was not optional. You had to have a hair light. Otherwise, portraits suck. That's just the way you were taught.
Right.
So when I see hair lights, more often than not, it just makes me, it makes the picture feel old to me.
Okay.
And notice in my work, I never use hair lights. I'll use rims to separate, but I won't use hair lights. So it's, and that's
just, so,
that's
so my just, can practice. You just explain the difference between a rim and a hair light?
Sure. So the hair light obviously is coming from above, and we can see that because we noticed that, you know, we've got highlight from the light on the top of his hair, but not on the side of his hair. And as we look at his shirt, the highlight that starts at his shoulders, especially on his chest, starts to kind of fade off as it gets further away. So there's a little bit of inverse square law happening there as well.
Yeah.
So the light's basically above. It's above him and slightly behind him, because if you come too far forward with your hair light, you light up the nose, which you don't want.
Yeah.
The rim lights are basically, you would need two to balance it. If you have a situation like this where you've got a subject and you're doing black on black and you don't want that floating head feel, then what you would do is you would have two lights in the back, one on either side. A lot of people will say, well, does it need to be like at 45 degrees or 35 degrees? It's like, stick it wherever you want it to be and see if, like, I have never in my life done the 45 degree thing. I could care less.
Right.
Right. If the bottom line with rim light, if you come too far forward, you light up the nose.
Yeah.
If you go too far back, you create flare because they're aiming the lens. So you find a sweet spot in the middle, which is usually going to be somewhere from 45 to 35 degrees.
Right.
But it doesn't be exactly at those numbers, right? And then the other important thing for me with rims and hair lights, so we can say this about both, they should never become a feature in the image, meaning there has to be detail. So many times you see newer young photographers when they're working on lighting initially, they kind of blow out whatever detail is where that rim or that hair light is.
Yeah.
And every now and then it looks cool. I mean, every now and then that works, but usually not.
Yeah.
Usually you want to be an accent, and accents should be subtle. So, you know, in this case, even part of what I've got going on here is the brightest part of the image, aside from the two catch lights in his eyes, is his hair.
Right.
So I'd love dial down maybe about a half a stop. And that way we're still going to get that separation on the shoulders. We're, you know, still going to be there. And again, being super, super picky here. It's not, I don't find it to be obnoxious. You've got detail through the hair. So like it checks off all the boxes for me, but yeah, if I'm really being fussy, yeah.
Well, I guess my thinking behind the whole thing was that I did want to separate him from the black backdrop, and yeah. That was kind of,
I think, for the sake of a picture of a guy and what you're telling me he wants to use it for, or et cetera, I think that's a good thing. I am very anti rules. So frequently, you know, you get the black on black and people are like, there's no separation. You have to have separation. It's like, I've never been arrested for not having separation. Lightning has not struck. Nobody took my cameras away. You know, yeah, there are times when a floating head actually looks really cool. In fact, you know, I'm a child of the 60s. So I remember when the Beatles and then 2 decades later, Queen sold a heck of a lot of records with floating heads on the cover.
Yeah.
Right? And they are iconic images.
Yep.
That we still look at today and say, whoa. So how's that wrong? Like, where did that, how did that, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's only wrong if it looks bad.
Yeah.
So I do agree with your choice. I think you absolutely made the right choice here. I don't think that you were going for something that was artistic with him. So it probably would not have made sense for him to, you know, kind of have the floating head thing. So I think when we hear those kind of rules, what people miss, there has to be context, you know, and the context is, why did we take the shot in the first place? It always comes back to the why. And that's the thing that so many people don't consider before they do a photo shoot. They don't consider all of the whys. And I'll gladly go a little bit deeper into that in a minute, but to finish up with this shot. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you told me that this is probably not the one that he's using for LinkedIn.
Yeah.
For a couple of reasons. Are you able to give me some sense of like what kind of work he does, or better yet, what his position is in the company?
His background is as a software engineer. He's now in a management role and leading a team of software engineers.
Okay, good, good. So, I mean, he does look, so just a couple things about the subject himself. He does look a little stoic. So obviously I realize this is probably not the image that he's using for LinkedIn. So I do think that in terms of a corporate portrait or a portrait that's going to be used for like resume purposes, that type of stuff, it's not that the person has to have a cheesy smile because they're horrible. We know that.
Yeah.
But it is helpful to try and get the person to relax to a point where they at least look pleasant, i.e., well, they'd be somebody that would be nice to work with, you know, kind of in that sense. In other words, to show a little bit of personality in the shot. Another thing that I will point out, so let's just say hypothetically, if this were the photo that he chose for LinkedIn and then potentially to maybe put like on his Facebook, you know, profile or whatever, I would recommend when you are planning shots that are going to be social media profiles, or even for that matter, could be used on company websites, you generally want the person's body angled in the other direction, going from left to right.
Oh, okay.
Now, certainly when it comes to, now you notice I said body, and I'll explain why in a minute. It'll be really obvious once I tell you, because the light bulb's going to go off.
Yeah, but I can see where you're going already. Yeah.
So for the face, you have to be a little bit careful that you can't always have them looking from left to right, because for some people, that means you're going to put their worst side forward.
Yeah.
So you may have to have them straight on. You may have to, you know, kind of fuss a little bit there, but that's where you can use the body angle. And the reason for that is, with all the social media sites, except for LinkedIn, LinkedIn recently made a change, but for all the social media sites, the profile image is on the left-hand side.
Yeah.
So you don't want the looking off of the page. That's a bad user experience. It sends people away. You want them looking into the page. If you have a person that you can't turn in that direction, that's okay. Don't turn them in that direction, but angle their body in that direction, and it gives the same feel. LinkedIn recently tweaked their profile images, so they're actually in the middle of the profile.
Right.
So if it's on LinkedIn, you know, you get a little bit more flexibility there than, you know, than what you used to get, because it's no longer on the left. So those are kind of all things to consider. And then for the shots that you did on the white background, is he wearing a t-shirt or is he wearing something else?
No, he wore the same t-shirt. And when he arrived, and I said, oh, we'll do some shots of you while we're waiting for Sybilla to get ready, because she was getting changed. And I said, did you bring a shirt, you know, with a collar? And he went, no, I wanted to do it in a black t-shirt. So that was his decision to do that.
If that's his decision, and hey, let's face it, Steve Jobs made a lot of money wearing a black t-shirt.
That's right.
So, yeah, I mean, that's fine. You said this guy works in tech. So, you know, that's a situation where it might work. I will say to you, though, for future reference, you actually just led me into one of the big whys that people don't talk about and don't think about when they plan their photo shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the biggest mistakes people make when they're shooting portraits is not asking why. Somebody says, hey, will you do a portrait of me? They're like, okay, sure. And everybody decides, great, we'll do it Saturday at 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
Meet me here. And there's no other information exchanged other than driving direction. So the photographer should be asking is, why do you need a portrait?
Yeah.
Where is it go? Because the why determines the needs. The why is what actually creates the rule. The rules shouldn't be about composition. The rules shouldn't be about lighting ratios or catch lights or anything like that. The rules are, what are we trying to accomplish with this photo?
Yeah.
Example, I had a young lady contact me recently who was one of my wife's former students. My wife is a college professor. This young lady has graduated. She has her PhD now. She's a psychologist. She's about to open up her practice. She knew that I was a photographer. She said, would you please do my pictures? I need a really, really nice headshot. And my web designer who's doing my website, he wants a photo of me kind of looking happy, because she specializes with working with children, looking happy, but, you know, just kind of standing looking at the camera that he's going to use on the front page of the website. And then the other one will be on the about page. I said, great. So the first question I had for her was, what color is your logo? And yeah. There was dead silence on the other end of the phone. And she's like, I know thinking one, but I don't know. And then she's like, why does that matter? And I'm like, well, he's probably going to use a color or the colors from your logo as accent colors throughout your website.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is a professional website, so I know it's going to be simple, meaning there's going to be white backgrounds and that, but there still is going to be accent colors. I said, we don't want you to come in wearing something that's going to clash with those colors. In fact, if anything, you should try and wear something that's in the same color range and tonal range, so that it helps reinforce that brand feel. And she's like, wow, I had no idea. So then she had the web guy and find out, okay, it's like a burgundy color. Awesome. Well, it turned out she had this really nice burgundy top with like a little sweater that she wore. And it was perfect. And it, you know, winds up when you go to the web page, it's got continuity. Like, you know, it all fits together. That color theme is consistent. And then, of course, the next questions I had for her, well, okay, so traditionally, and it's not a rule, but traditionally on about pages, the photo goes in the upper left. Is that going to be in the case in, you know, in your about page? And then that home page picture, where literally we kind of did the cheesy, you know, shot of her standing there looking really happy with her arms folded. Okay. But it actually worked out really nice. The guy did a great job on the design. But the question was, well, where is he going to put you? Is he putting you in the middle with information on both sides? Are you going to be in the right? Are you going to be in the left? Because we need to know which way to angle you. And what I wound up doing is I shot a couple variations anyway, but by knowing in advance, these are the design plans, I was able to make sure that the pictures that we took were actually going to meet her needs, as opposed to her just walking away with what she asked for, which was two variations on a portrait.
Yeah.
And I also explained to her, make sure you wear solid colors, no prints, no patterns, no floral. They are all distractions. We want people to see you. Fortunately, even though she's a clinical psychologist, she had to take cognitive psychology classes, so she understood the distraction aspect of it. It's fine with that.
Yep.
We kept the jewelry to a minimum. Again, we wanted people to see her, and that was even important given that she's working with kids. We want parents to see her as, you know, very approachable. She is young. She just got her PhD, and she looks young, which is actually an asset given the type of clientele that she has. So, you know, all of that, when the thought process behind the expressions that we needed from her, you know, all of that stuff to be able to get shots together. So why drives the process? Always. And so that brings us to your headshots now.
Yep.
With his daughter, the things that you have to consider for headshots. Headshots are actually one of the toughest images to do in terms of making them successful. And when I say successful, I don't mean good compositions of lighting. I mean, in terms of do they actually help the person get hired? Because what the headshot does, its role is to get that person in the door for an audition, because there's two things that get them in the door for an audition. One is their resume. The other is the headshot.
Yep.
And, you know, for a model, when a model walks into a modeling agency, they have a portfolio or an advance. They've sent what's called a comp card or a Zed card. And that has four, five, sometimes even six photos on it. And there'll be full length pictures and three quarter length headshots. But actors, dancers, they get one picture.
Right.
So that one picture, it actually has to tell a lot. Now, you know, you would think, well, okay, they're a dancer. We should show them doing like some cool dance move. No, no, no. That's the resume is going to do that. And they will still have to audition. But what you do need to make sure that you're showing when you do an acting headshot, or we'll call it a talent headshot for the sake of fact. It could be acting, it could be dancers, whatever.
Yeah.
You have to show enough in your composition to give a sense of their body type. So I will tell you that both of these shots are cropped just a little tight. And this is coming from a guy, you know, in my work, I frequently crop really tight and get really close, but that's not for headshots.
Yeah.
So if I'm shooting a headshot for somebody that's, you know, going for some type of talent, I've got to back up a little bit. I have no problem cropping off the top of the head. I do that all the time. The only people that ever talk about the top of the head missing, again, they're people with cameras. I've never had my stuff. They, oh my God, my head, where did it go? Like, nobody's ever said that ever. So they're fine.
Yeah.
And even in the industry, people understand, yes, they have a top to their head. It's okay. So, but what you do want to do is you want to make sure that you can see the person's neck, because actually, if you think about meeting people and even over the next couple of days, as you just walk around through life, look at people, you'll realize that a neck is actually a really good indicator in terms of the person's fitness.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like how muscular they are, but I mean, are they skinny? Are they heavy? Are they obese?
Yep.
The person's neck is actually a great clue to that. So it actually gives you a really good sense of the person's body type. Certainly doesn't tell you everything you want to know, but it gives you a good sense. So definitely seeing the neck. So obviously like the black and white shot kind of covers her neck and we don't see any shoulders. So we don't have a sense of, you know, is she really broad shouldered? Is she super, super skinny where the collarbones are really, really going to stick out? Those types of things. So right. Just a matter of loosening up a little bit. And then the other thing to consider, and this is, I will be the first to tell you up front as I explain this, you hear some people in the industry say this doesn't matter as much. I'm a firm believer in the idea that it does. And that is that you need to show some personality in a headshot. And especially for a dancer, people will think, well, it's a dancer. It's a dancer. No, 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 no. Because a good dancer, it's not about the choreography. The expectation is that a good dancer better be able to do the choreography or forget it. You have no career ahead of you.
Yeah.
The really good dancer, though, is the one that can take all that technical aspect and who can be an actress and sell it and literally bring it to life. And that is acting.
Right.
So to have a little bit of kind of energy in the picture, not to sound too artsy, you know, instead of saying like happy or smiley, but energy, something that's a little special. I know, you know, the very famous Peter Hurley talks about the squinch, which is ridiculous.
The what?
He's on record of saying that. But, you know, he's working with actors in New York that have very impressive resumes. If you ask the average person to squinch, they're going to make a lot of really stupid looking expressions, period.
What's a squinch?
So, and I don't want to get it wrong. So basically it's like his trademark thing. It's kind of like Tyra Banks with her schmizing, you know, smile with your eyes.
Okay.
Peter Hurley squinches. The idea is you're pulling in the center of your forehead with your eyebrows a little bit, just to ever so slightly squint so that you have this expression that kind of makes people look at you and wonder, like, what are they thinking? What's going on?
Right.
And it is. Then let me actually throw some science behind what he does, because there's a lot of value to it. So let me be really clear. Peter Hurley makes a lot more money than I do, so I'm not saying. I'm just saying, wait, let's put things in context here, right? He, you know, he basically between New York and L.A. He works primarily with actors. His sessions are extremely expensive. The average beginning actor could not even afford him if they needed to. So he's working with people that have skill set, right? Average photographer who can do acting headshots is not working with people of the caliber that Peter Hurley is. But from the cognitive standpoint, going back to that psychology stuff, our brains have certain expression that the brain recognizes almost instantly. In fact, so fast that we are not cognitively aware of it. They're expressions that are called prototype expressions. There are seven of them. As an example, one of them is an expression that's called the Duquesne smile. And the Duquesne smile, most of us know it as cheese.
Right.
That's what we know it as, which basically means it's boring. When we see it, our brain process, it connects with that image or with that look so fast that we essentially ignore it. We find it absolutely boring. So even, you know, and again, don't take Joel Edelman's word for it. I'm some guy that you picked up on YouTube, right? So as you start looking around, like at ads in magazines or, you know, driving down the highway and there's a billboard with a person smiling, you'll notice, and I'm not saying all the time, so this is never is a bad word, but you'll notice the overwhelming majority of the time when you see a person smiling in an ad, there's something that's a little off about the smile. My phrase is flawed expression. And you can tell the person's happy, but it's not a cheesy smile. And believe me, that's very intentional. Advertising is very expensive. And in the advertising world, they don't take a lot of risks. They use a lot of science to make sure that they're going to get the desired result from what they do. So these expressions that are a little bit off force people to pay more attention and to consider what they're seeing, which makes them pay more attention. So the expression in an acting exercise, so it's the same kind of thing. If you have an expression that's kind of flat or too simple or too big and too cheesy, you've gone these two extremes that actually, to the brain, make it somewhat boring. So an expression that's got a little bit of life to it, it's got a little bit of character, is always going to get people to pay more attention. So like out of the two shots that you have, the color one actually comes a lot closer. I really wish, if it were my style of shooting headshot, I wish her mouth was a little bit more relaxed and the lips weren't quite as pursed.
Right.
But because the lips are pursed and there's that little bit of happy going on, and because she's staring down the barrel of the lens, there's a little bit more there that's going to engage. We also know that the human brain, two extremely important markers, and all this comes from science, by the way. So folks, you can Google this stuff. It's spelled G-O-O-G-L-E. You can check it out. I'm not making this stuff up. This is actual cognitive science. The most important marker and one other very important marker in the human brain for determining beauty, number one, is symmetry.
Yep.
Now, of course, the irony of it is, human beings are not symmetrical. If you ever meet a symmetrical human being, it's probably time to run, not walk in the other direction. The aliens are here. It's over. Okay. But yet, ironically, we try for that. So since I used Peter Hurley as the example, I'll go back to him. And if you Google him and look at his work, you'll notice the overwhelming majority of headshots that people are looking straight at the camera. There's no head tilts or turn. There's head tilts to the side, but never turn.
Yeah.
So he's having these people look straight at the camera, and generally, if he's having them turn in one direction or another, they are a person that has one eye that is noticeably larger than the other. So he's turning the head to balance that a little bit to get back to more of a symmetrical feel. So the color headshot with this young lady is much more engaging because she's looking right down the barrel lens. She's got kind of an interesting, almost like I know something you don't know kind of expression going on.
Yeah.
So it's not an expression that's obviously happy. It's not an expression that's obviously serious. It engages. It pulls us in. So that would be my favorite of the two for the headshot scenario.
Yep.
Again, I wish it had just a little bit more space around it.
Okay, so let me just say that crop is not final. What I sent to her to send on to her agent is not cropped. So her designer will have the option to then crop as they need to.
Awesome. Excellent. So, and then the only other thing, which again, her agent will probably not fuss about it. So this is Joe being really picky and kind of using science to optimize. The challenge for like models, actors, all that is, you know, they only have one guarantee in their whole casting process. That one guarantee is failure. Nobody gets every job. You know, you can walk into a casting as a dancer, you could be the best dancer there, and the casting director, whoever's making the selections, prefers blondes. Well, then this young lady's out of luck.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how good the dancer is, right? So basically, when it comes to your marketing materials, and when I say marketing material, I mean your headshots, even the way they dress when they go and the way they behave and everything else, it's kind of like being an athlete, actually, where you have to optimize everything that you can. So even one of the things that I would definitely make it a point to always remove if you are doing an acting headshot or any kind of talent headshot is jewelry.
Yeah.
There is a lot of research and studies that have shown that literally just a simple diamond stud or a simple little pearl earring, when they do eye tracking, where they sit a person in front of a computer and they ask the person to look at a picture and then for like 30 seconds. And then they'll ask the person to tell them what they noticed about the picture and what they spent the most time studying in that. But the whole time they're using cameras that are able to track every little eye movement down to a fraction of movement.
Right.
Find out the person will say, oh, well, you know, her eyes were amazing. And this, and when in reality, they were looking at jewelry like almost 40% of the time that they were staring at the picture.
Wow.
So if a portrait client comes in to you and, you know, they're wearing this like kind of gaudy choker around their neck or necklace, and you know, you say, hey, you know, could we do this without the jewelry? And they're like, but my grandmother gave me this. Like, you know, it means everything. Well, obviously they're paying client. They want that choker or that necklace. They're going to wear it and you're going to do it. That's fine.
Yeah.
In the case of like a talent headshot, ideally, yes, you want it just the person, nothing fancy, nothing extra. Because again, when they get hired, yes, the dancer has to bring a skill, but in terms of the way they're going to do her hair, the way they're going to do her makeup, the way they will costume her, she is essentially going to portray a character. It's not going to be her that doing the performance piece. So they want to see, you know, what is our canvas that we're working with. Plus, it's worth, you know, adding that between clothing and jewelry dates a photo faster than clothing does. Clothing always cycles back around. Like, I don't know about you folks down under, but here in the U.S. this year, we're like back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Everybody's doing the same colors this year. It's like, oh my God, you know, at least the styles aren't quite as crazy as the 80s, but the fluorescent colors are back, right?
Yeah.
So, and this is not the first time they've been back since the 1980s. So the clothing cycles around. Jewelry doesn't really go through trends. Different pieces of jewelry will go through trends, but actual styles don't.
Right.
And so jewelry made an image even faster, not to mention, and sorry, ladies, if you're listening, but women sometimes, they can be a little catty about things. So if you're an actor or an actress, whatever, you don't want to go into a casting and have somebody looking and say, oh my God, those earrings, what the hell are they thinking? Right? Like, you want them to be looking at just you and judging just you. So you leave all foo-foo and accoutrements out of the image and you make it just you.
Nice. Excellent, Joe.
Does that help?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you.
You're
No, there's a lot to think about. And like I said, I don't do it often enough. I really need to set the backdrops up and get the monoblocks out a little bit more often and do this more often.
So. Yeah. And, you know, let's face it, if you need a challenging subject to work with, just bring linen.
With the exception that he lives 1,000 kilometers from where I am.
Okay, well, there you go. That's
yes. Anyway, so what else have you been up to lately? Anything exciting?
You know, living the dream.
Excellent.
I'm doing a lot of traveling and a lot of teaching, which is great. Olympus has been awesome. You know, since becoming a visionary, they send me around. I mean, I do the major trade shows here in the U.S. I did Photo Plus, WPPI, and Imaging USA. Recently, did Shutterfest. So a lot of teaching. I did recently just sign a lease on a new studio.
Oh, nice!
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I'm also, you know, kind of waking up every day thinking, "What the hell are you doing?" You know, I'm getting old now. I'm supposed to be slowing down, not starting new studios. And the nice part of this is it's a studio in a building that's an old cigar factory.
Wow.
That was bought out and kind of fixed up and turned into artist lofts.
Oh, nice.
So rent is very reasonable. The building is amazing because it is a lot of old red brick, and the entire building really is decorated. There's all kinds of art. There's entire hallways that are painted with graffiti, and It's very colorful and very bright. So I had been looking at this space for about a year and kind of going back and forth. Like, it'd be really nice to have a space. It's a studio that everybody sees on YouTube. I made no secret about the fact that it's in a basement. I'm able to do all that work.
Yeah.
So I am limited in terms of, you know, being able to have like dancers or people jumping and that kind of stuff. So I've been looking for a space, and I kept looking at the website for this building, and the only space that was big enough, it was like a middle space. So it had two windows at the end and only one section of brick wall. It was kind of really just boring, and it wasn't quite as big as I really wanted. So I wasn't willing to compromise the size considering the space wasn't that tight. So finally, I just was getting frustrated. I knew I needed to do something. I wanted to be able to have a bigger space to work in. So I made an appointment to go look at this. I thought, well, maybe it'll be better when I see it in person. And the day that I went to look at it, the gentleman who was the leasing agent, we're walking back, and he's like, yeah, it's right around this corner. But before I show you that one, this space just opened up. There used to be a little marketing company in here. And he opened the door, and my chin hit the floor. It had along one wall about 24 feet of window that is like 6 feet tall.
Oh, wow.
And it had 2 5-foot by 6-foot windows. And I'm looking at this, and I said to the guy, I said, that long window, is that north? And the guy's like, yeah, should I charge you more? I'm like, no, 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 you can't charge me more. You already told me what it costs, but you have to understand, the photographer, that's gold.
Yeah.
Like, it's just this massively huge north-facing window with 2 east-facing windows. So the only direct sun that comes into the space is
early morning.
9:30 a.m. in the morning, and it's a tiny little bit of sunlight that comes in through the 2 east-facing windows. But the entire rest of the day, it's this massive softbox.
Wow.
Like, oh, gosh, I have to do this now. So that was 3 weeks ago, or 2 weeks ago, I got the keys. So I've been, you know, kind of moving stuff in and getting stuff set up and trying to kind of do it actually really sparse initially, because I want to use the natural light. That was not part of my game plan, but the natural light is just so wonderful that, yeah, I've got to play with this, and I've got to make this part of my repertoire now. So that's kind of exciting. And it's only about a 15-minute drive from home. So it's close by, and fortunately, it's not like I had to buy a lot of equipment. I had enough equipment. So I still do all my YouTube work here, you know, in the home studio. I do my live streams here and that. I'm going to look into doing them there at the new space, because it certainly looks a lot cooler. But for now, you know, I'll maintain both spaces. Let's see. So that's kind of keeping me busy at the moment. I'm getting ramped up. Next week, I actually have my first full-blown shoot. I've done a couple little practice sessions this week to get a feel for how things will flow with the ambient light and everything. But
yeah, so I was gonna ask you, what, while you were talking, I was trying to find it, but I can't actually find it right now. But you posted an image in the last day or so, and it looked like a girl in a room very much like you've described. I'm wondering, is that the space?
Just today, yeah. So on Instagram, actually, and on my Facebook profiles, just did it. And it's just a simple natural light portrait.
Yeah.
But it's literally the girl sitting in the middle of the room. It's handheld, a 50th of a second,
yep,
shot at f1.2. And yeah, it's just the sweetest light.
Yeah.
It looks like amazing.
It is beautiful, yeah.
So yeah, so I'm looking forward to, you know, to playing around with that quite a bit, and you know, also having a lot more space to do a lot of things that I haven't done in quite a few years. So,
and I'm guessing it's a higher ceiling than your basement.
Oh yeah, I left that out, didn't I? Yes, it's a 14-foot ceiling, so I got a lot of space. It's
awesome. Yeah. So you'll be hanging lighting racks from way up high.
Yeah, I mean, eventually. So what I'm working with initially is I do have stands set up, you know, using lights on stands. I'm actually trying at first, you know, when I built the home studio, and I talked about this in the video that I did about my home studio, I had the best part of a year to plan for the studio and how I wanted to set it up.
Nice.
So I went in with a really, really solid plan, and I actually did a really good job. There's very, very little that's changed in this phase in terms of how I do things from when I first moved in.
Yeah.
Since I didn't have that kind of lead time going into this new space, and since the natural light is so amazing, I decided, all right, you know, I can set up lighting anywhere in any way, shoot exactly what I shoot here at home. But I don't want to go in and start mounting all kind of stuff and building things. I want to go in and just use it. So literally I created a dressing room by using the Bogan auto poles that are, you know, stretched between the floor and the ceiling. And I have, you know, a square off area with material with setup so that, you know, model has privacy to change. I did hang a backdrop setup, which is similar to something I had done years and years ago in another studio, which is actually a rope and pulley system. So really easy to set up, require any hardware other than a couple little eyelets to go into a beam and ceiling. So it's really easy to get, you know, background set up. So I can stretch those backgrounds all the way up to about 13 and a half feet above the floor.
Wow.
And the room itself is interesting. So, I mean, just even like the shot that I just posted, again, it's not like one of those wow, crazy beauty shots, but it's a real sweet, real softly lit, really focused on the personality kind of image. And the background is actually one of the east facing windows and some brick wall and, you know, real shallow depth of field. So nice. Yeah, it's going to be definitely going to be a lot of fun. You know, for me, I feel it's kind of a little bit rejuvenating in the sense that I can really kind of break out of some of the habits. I mean, everybody knows me for the beauty work and I appreciate that. And I love it and it will never go away.
Yeah.
It's just something I really have fun doing, but there's a lot of work, you know, styles of work and types of images that I haven't done for the past 5 years because I just really haven't had the space to do them. So it's going to be kind of fun to get back into that. And honestly, right now I feel like I'm learning all over again. Because when you start in a new space like that, you want to learn all the nuances.
Yeah.
Like in terms of how's the light flowing, what happens if you do this, how about if you change that? So that's where I'm at right now. I've, you know, just literally just playing around to kind of see what I can mess up with lighting, figure out, like, hey, this is because oftentimes for me, that's always been where my best ideas come from. It's the mistake. The more I screw something up, the cooler it turns out because it's going to take me someplace that I didn't expect.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really where I'm at with it right now is mixing in a little bit of LEDs with some of the natural light, working with the strobes, and then figuring out kind of where I need to be to overpower the ambient. Because I'm hoping to not have to go in and put material up to block the light. I mean, certainly if I want to do any kind of time exposure, I would have to do that. But I want to be able to leave those windows nice and bright. So that also means from, you know, a lighting standpoint, if I'm going to do one of my beauty shots with strobes, I need to make sure that I'm killing the ambient with the strobes.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at right now. Experimenting through all of that, getting a feel for routine. Next week I have a makeup artist coming in and got a couple shoots set up. So that's when I get to really start playing. So it'll be fun.
Well, mate, that sounds very exciting. So, yeah, awesome. Well, Joe, thank you once again for coming back on the podcast. It's been great to have you on, and I've appreciated your constructive criticism of my images.
Thank you. I hope you're as tough as your partner is.
and I really do appreciate some of those tips that just regarding the execution of those portraits, they will be things that I'll file away and try and remember for next time that I'm doing that. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
So Joe can be found on YouTube. He can be found on Instagram. He can be found on Facebook.
Yep.
I will put all of the links to Joe's various social media outlets on the show notes for this episode, and as a portrait photographer, he's definitely worth checking out. And Joe, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure, Bruce. As always, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
No worries. All right, and there's really nothing else I need to add, so I will speak with you next week.
Shutters Inc. Another audio2.com quality podcast. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@shuttersincpodcast.com.